It's time for another episode of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes. Here's your host, Terrence McCauley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My guest today is Adam Sykes. He is a novelist, a Marine Corps veteran, a Silver Star recipient, and a former CIA paramilitary officer. To put that in perspective with me today, I had cereal and baby talk to my cat. So that'll give you a bit of a difference of our life experiences. Man, that's impressive. The Underhanded is his latest novel, and it is published by Ocean View and is available everywhere. Adam, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Terrence, thank you. Really grateful to be on your show today. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about your latest book, The Underhanded?
Sure. So this is my second novel. The first one was Landslide, and that was about a gentleman who ends up in war-torn Ukraine. And that was a more traditional spy novel, I think. The Underhanded is also a spy thriller. It's set in Europe, but it's about a professor. Rather than somebody who's had some type of secret or military background, it's about a professor who finds himself in a situation where his life isn't what he'd think it is, but he's thrust into a situation where he's going up against this cabal who's trying to disrupt the fabric of Western society in Europe, a group of neo-fascists and extremists. And he is teamed up with a MI6 officer who's also a little bit on the outs from her agency, and they have to go about this together.
Great. Great. Now, what was it that made you want to write about someone from academia as opposed to staying in the wheelhouse that you know so well of military operations, CIA operations, things like that?
Well, as you know, Terrence, we write about what we know. We write about what we're interested in. You have some great historical books that you've written that I found fascinating. Your latest one was Chicago. That one's just wonderful. And some of the other stuff you've written.
Thank you.
So with The Underhanded, it is, in fact, based on some of my experiences. So in the 1990s, when I was in the Marine Corps, I had some experiences in the Balkans. So I got to see some of what was happening over there with Bosnia and the extremism and the genocide and a few other things. Fast forward a few years later, when I'm at university, I encounter a professor who worked in orphanages in the Balkans in the 90s. And we happened to be the same age, so we became good friends. But he was a professor over there working in an orphanage. And then a few years back, when I was with the agency, I encountered some extremist nationalistic situations in Eastern Europe. So I took those three elements right there, and I'm a academically trained historian as it is. And I said, you know what? I'd really like to make this individual, create this character who has an academic background, but it also maybe has some experiences that would drive his motivations and maybe some of his choices in life. So that's where I came up with this professor who had experiences in Bosnia, and his kind of academic career got kind of thrashed for a bit, and he finds himself at a low point, and that's when the story kicks off.
That's fascinating that you were willing to expand your craft outside of what one would expect you to know, which was just the military aspect of it and some of the intelligence aspect, and branch out into an academic area. And you said you're a classically trained historian. What era of history did you focus on, if any?
So it was the Atlantic world. So think of the time between 1492 up till right before World War I. And it's the collision, the encounters, the integration of peoples, things, and events that were going on between Europe, North America, South America, and Africa. So when you think of, you know, how the slave trade and what was going on back then, how that impacted certain elements of South America and North American society and the intersections of people and places and things and It was the Colonia area as well. I focused on the Seven Years' War, one of the first truly world wars. I
Right.
spent a lot of time focusing on that, and I did a comparison with how the Seven Years' War came about, and then the start of World War One and a few other things.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? When, well, I always suggest that authors who are looking for inspiration look to history to see what happened before, because those things tend to crop up again later on. It's not just dead. History is very much alive if you read it close enough and study it close enough. It's not boring at all.
No, and it comes back around. We see similar things that we've seen in the past. You know, they say history repeats itself if we don't pay attention, but it does. We can draw parallels from what we see today from stuff that was going on 50, 100, 200 years ago.
Right. It all, unfortunately, it all comes back, is that I don't think people fundamentally really change. Nations are very slow to change, as a matter of fact. It's funny, I just saw someone post today about the original map that James K. Polk had when he was talking about expanding the United States. And it's much different. I mean, people just figure out from one ocean to the other. But also further south, he wanted to go a lot further south, like to include Cuba and half of what is modern day Mexico, all the way over to Baja California. And that's a part of history that a lot of people don't understand, but it speaks very much to your understanding of what the Atlantic world was like back then, between 1492 and all the way up to the dawning of World War I.
Yeah, there's some excellent work out there about the Western United States. When we think about, you know, Manifest Destiny and the expansion over to the West, there were so many different people from different backgrounds, cultures, intermixing out there in the West. It wasn't just what would become Americans moving out there and encountering the, you know, the indigenous people, the Native Americans. There was also the Spanish out there, the French out there, the Chinese, the Russians. There were so many people that were intermixing out there before these states were formed. And then you think about the power structures that were created and how they interacted economically and politically, and sometimes with the conflict that would with these different groups and peoples out there, and how the it's fascinating stories, these families and groups that were interacting out there.
And you've definitely, for your modern day thrillers, you've really touched on a hotbed of relevancy. You know, one of my mentors told me, why this book and why now? And no matter when you set it, whether it's a Western or a techno thriller or whatever, you have to be able to answer those two questions if you hope to be able to find an audience. It's great that you have this appreciation of history, both here in the United States and abroad from your service. And it's wonderful that you use that appreciation of foreign history to incorporate that into the books that you have written, that you have not, you've almost ripped them from today's headlines in the settings where you've had them, but you have an appreciation of how we get there, and that is reflected in the books you write.
Yeah, I really enjoy thrillers, adventure books, and spy books that bring in an element of the history or the current events. You can't be too close to current events because by the time you write it and the book gets published, as you know, things may have changed drastically. But to be able to include those elements in your plot is something I really enjoy. And I appreciate and have always enjoyed studying European history and how events from either political, military, or diplomatic have evolved in Europe. And so that was one of the reasons for the underhanded. I picked the Franco-Prussian War as kind of some of the underpinnings of the plot there, where you have this conflict between France and Germany that ended up with an area in Europe where Strasbourg, where you have the intersection of the French and the German people, and you have this melding. But then that also sparks over the next, you know, 50 years nationalistic sentiment, and some of it leading to the rise of the Nazis and World War II, and how these different groups collided with each other and how they maneuvered in the power struggles that went on. And I kind of wanted to take that through this story and connect it all the way up through the Cold War with the Balkans, and then what we're seeing today with some of the extremism that's rearing its head in Europe now.
Unfortunately, it's funny. A couple of weeks ago, I had the good fortune to interview Bernard Cornwell for this podcast, and he's God knows he loves his history, and he is the definition of being able to take historical events and make them relevant and action-packed and really engaging. And we talked a lot about that and how Americans don't necessarily have an appreciation for European history because and some of the wars that happened because I don't think we really appreciate the geography of it because Europe's a lot smaller than we think. America thinks, oh, every country is 3,000 miles wide. It's just not the case. You can visit several countries in Europe if you plan it right in one day. And that's within a week you can hit almost all of them if you plan it right. And that's that having that kind of knowledge and that kind of appreciation for it is rare, and it creates a really great setting for a story.
Oh yeah, you're absolutely right. Europe is very small, geographically, relatively speaking, but yet also so different. And you can find yourself in Spain, France, Italy, and Germany in completely different environments very quickly. Short, quick digression. Bernard Cornwell is one of my favorite authors. I've been reading him for years. Love Sharp's Rifles, but the first time I saw the miniseries Sharp's Rifled, believe it or not, I was in Afghanistan, and we had the DVDs, and this was maybe 10 years ago. So I'd read all the books, but a gentleman I was with had all the DVDs. So we would watch Sharp's Rifles on the TV there. That was pretty exciting, pretty fun.
And they were very loyal to the books too. And you couldn't have picked a better Richard Sharp than Sean Bean,
Oh
who in
yeah.
his own right is just a cut up and a badass individual on his own. He was fantastic. The only thing is, I wish they would redo the musical score to those because they're a little 90s synth dated, and I wish someone would come along and change that out. But other than that, what's there is awesome. It really is.
Yeah, with the music, you had that electric guitar whammy bar or something.
That's the only dated part of it, believe it or not. The rest of the stuff is awesome, and it's but they're great stories. And with Richard Sharp, those books always show an evolution of the Sharp character from the early books all the way through his life until the TV series ends. And of course, he's thank God kept the Sharp series going. Do you envision yourself also writing a series of novels, or do you like standalones at this point in your career?
So I'm a very diverse reader, and I really enjoy series. And there's some great ones out there, and I love when I pick them up because I feel like I'm coming back to an old friend. And then I also really enjoy standalone. So right now, both books I've written, Landslide and The Underhanded, are the first books in what will be series. I'm frantically trying to finish the sequel to Landslide right now, which we'll go back and see Mason Hack Delgado and Another Adventure. And I'm plotting the sequel to The Underhanded right now because you got to have multiple products going at once. The standalone, though, is a book that's still kind of in formation. I'm still putting it together, but that will be a project in the next year as well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it's good that from an artistic standpoint to approach it from the fact that you're going to keep yourself fresh. You're not just going to stay with one project, one series, one set of characters. I find it's great if you're able to do more than one over a cycle because you're always pushing yourself in another direction, and that's always good for yourself and for the reader.
Well, I agree. Writing for me is very much an art and a craft. It's also, I would say, therapeutic and a passion.
I would
And
imagine.
I listened to one of your podcasts earlier, and James Grady said it perfectly for me. And it really clicked with me when he said it. It's something I've been thinking about for probably 15, 20 years. But I think he articulated it best, which was, I'm writing because I'm trying to make sense of the things I've seen and the experiences I've had. And that rung true for me. When I joined the Marine Corps, I was 19. And yeah, the first place we went was the Balkans. And so being put in that kind of situation as a 19-year-old kid, just able to vote the year prior and not able to drink yet, legally drink yet, that was a formative experience for me. And then, 9/11 happens, and I find myself at the agency, and all different types of things have happened over the years, as well as in my personal life. And I'm still trying to make sense of a lot of it and understand what that means, not just for me, but maybe for those around me and the greater society. And that's what writing is doing. So the ability to explore different characters, different settings, and different themes is my way of chipping apart that granite that I'm trying to get at.
And that's important too. I just recently interviewed another writer who's a former military officer who had a ton of experience like you have, Jack Beaumont. He's a Frenchman, French fighter pilot, was in the DGSC. I mean, just all of these different awesome experience he's had, but he tries to get at the humanity of the thriller that he's writing because he understands that it's not just the bang bang, kicking the door, awesome weaponry and tactics. It's in order to engage, you have to have something that the reader can relate to. And it sounds like you found that exact same thing. And he finds that incredibly therapeutic for himself too, because he, like you, has seen an awful lot.
Yeah, it's challenging to explore that. I think one thing that I try to do, and some people I think understand and others may not, is like you said, those action scenes with the bang bang or the fight scene or something like that. It's not just the physical aspect of what's going on there. Inside, within us, there is a conflict going on inside us as well, with what we're doing and what we're doing to other people and how we're going to make it through that. And sometimes you've got to really compartmentalize that and just, for lack of a better term, put your head down, drive forward and move on and do some very tough things, whether that's, shooting, moving, communicating, medicating, all those things in a hostile environment. But then how do you come to grips with that after the fact? How do you make sense of some of the things you've done and then have to do them immediately again? And you keep going through that. And so you have this internal struggle when you come out of that stuff.
And the best writers are able to convey that, and they're always looking for a way to push themselves to be able to bring that to the audience. And you seem to certainly be well on your way to doing that. You also co-wrote a nonfiction book as well, and that must have been an interesting experience for you. Where did that happen in your career? Was that one of the first things you did, then you became a novelist, or did you bookend that between your the two novels that you've already released?
So I wrote my first scene for a novel in 2012 in East Africa. And I rewrote that scene probably 40 times, but I wanted to be a novelist. Up until that point, I'd always considered myself a writer, but I'd never put my pen to paper when it came to nonfiction. It'd always been in a, or put my pen to paper in a fiction context. It'd always been nonfiction or academic. So for a number of years, I was working on fiction. I wrote a manuscript that thankfully will never be published because it was atrocious. But eventually I get to what would become Landslide. Well, as I was starting to write Landslide, my agent called me up. And her name's Judy Kapaj, and just a fabulous, fabulous woman. She calls me up, and she one of the other folks she represents is Jim DeFelice, who wrote American Sniper with Chris Kyle. Jim came across this woman named Niloufar Rahmani, who was Afghanistan's first female Air Force fixed-wing pilot. And she wanted to write her story. Jim didn't have the time, but he talked to his agent, and she says, "I know a guy who might be interested." And she calls me up and says, "Adam, I think you're the one to write this." I said, "Okay." And so she put us in touch, Niloufar and I, and we chatted and we talked a little about her life because I hadn't known her before then. And I'd been to Afghanistan number of times. I've spent a couple of years there. And after that conversation, I said, yeah, we think we can do this. So we wrote a proposal, or I put Landslide, my fiction, on pause. We wrote a proposal, and Chicago Review Press picked it up, and we had a year to write it. And so Niloufar and I went back and forth for a year to write her story. And it's an amazing story. Her family is an amazing story. She grew up under the Taliban. Her father fought in the Soviet-Afghan War. He was a civil engineer. Her mother was amazing. She was on her way to be an international journalist. The Taliban came into power. They were refugees in Pakistan for a while. 9/11 happens. They're back in Afghanistan. And she's growing up under this, going to school, trying to figure things out. And then the Afghan Air Force starts recruiting women to be pilots, and she's one of the first one. And so she becomes the first Afghan female fixed-wing Air Force pilot. She gets trained at one point in the States to fly C-130s, doing some amazing things. And the Taliban had already targeted her for assassination. They were going after her and her family, multiple attempts.
Wow.
But when she was in the States doing her C-130 training to fly those types of aircraft, when she graduated, he called her father, who was still in Kabul, and he said, you can't come home because they're going to kill you. And it was her own unit. They knew where she was. She wouldn't have lasted long. So that's when she sought political asylum, and she's been in the States. And we met, obviously, a few years later. We you know, it was when we started writing the book, but that was her story. And it came out, the book released the very month that the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan.
Wow.
And so as she was promoting the book, we were also frantically trying to find a way to get the rest of her family out of Afghanistan.
Right.
Her parents, her brothers and sisters, and they all made it. They all made it. Lots of phone calls, lots of favors, but they all made it. For protection, I won't say where they are in the States, but
right.
they're all here safe and sound now. And it's really kind of an amazing story that after all they went through, they're now here enjoying what we have to offer and the freedoms we have in the U.S.
Thank God. Thank God for that. I'm glad they were able to make it out. And she's just such an inspiring story. I recommend that book to everyone. What's the name of that book also?
It's called Open Skies, My Life as Afghanistan's First Female Pilot.
Wow. Fantastic. And it's amazing because that's what I think separates your writing from a lot of the others out there, is that you really do take the time to show the audience that even if you're writing a novel, that there are human beings behind all of these things. And it's not just the people sometimes, I think, in this culture just label people blindly. And they think, well, anybody who's in the military is just used to telling orders, being a machine, and just doing what they're told. And I think what they lose sight of there is the humanity of it, that, you know, yeah, you plan the fun things, all right, the action stuff, the things that look good on screen and on a movie. But there's doing that, there's the planning that goes into that, and then there's also the planning that gets out of it. And it's the human toll that it takes on the people for both sides to work. Because if it doesn't work all the way through, it doesn't work at all. And I think that you found a really great, I don't want to say niche, but you've definitely found a unique voice where you highlight that. And I think that's going to really be the thing that separates you from a lot of the other thrillers out there.
Oh, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I try to bring a lot of that out, because you're right. You know, all these things that are happening, we're not automatons out there. And there's humans, there's emotions, there's decisions, there's gut reactions, there's bad decisions, all these things happening. And how do you, as a person, get back up when you've been knocked down? And keep going and keep making decisions with all the turmoil and garbage and darkness that can sometimes plague you.
Right. Yeah. And that's incredibly rare to be able to bring that out and bring it out convincingly. Now, I know that The Underhanded is your latest book. That's out now from Ocean View. And I was wondering, how long will it be until your next book comes out? I know you mentioned earlier that you're in various stages of development. When can the public expect to see the next great book from you.
My plan is in the next 2 weeks to finish the final draft of the sequel to Landslide. And if all goes well, that would come out in the next year.
Awesome.
So my aim right now is to try to push out a book a year, hopefully. You know, that there's a lot of life responsibilities, as we all know.
Oh,
So
yeah.
yeah, with the time I have in the day, if I can push out a book a year, I will be very content. And then maybe in the future I can do two, but right now a book a year is the goal.
Right. Well, it's important to own your craft and know your own limits, and there's no bonus points for pushing yourself beyond what you can do. It's nice to say, but you're doing it right, and you're doing it the best way possible. And I think the audiences are definitely going to be impressed with this next one that comes out.
Oh, thank you, Terrence. Yeah, it's a pleasure to speak with you. You're such a prolific writer in multiple genres yourself, and you have this podcast. It's really, to me, it's inspiring to see how you've embraced this art and this craft and this industry to do what you're doing. So, thank you for having me on.
Oh, of course. Now, what's the best way that people can follow you on social media, your website, places like that?
So, folks, looking for the website, it's adamsykes.com. It should come right up. I'm also on Instagram, X, Threads, and Facebook. It's either Adam R. Sykes or Adam Sykes. But all the links are on the website. The books are available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, as well as your local bookstore. And I hope people check them out.
I think they will. And when you go on social media, everybody just look for the Squared Away Marine. He will definitely come up in the Facebook posts, and you will have no question as to who he is. So, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate
Terrence, this was an amazing way to start my day. Thank you so
it.
much.
Thank you, my friend. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We'll see you next time, everyone. Take care.
You have been listening to Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes with host Terrence McCauley on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.